This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, March 14th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
And KUAF is supported by Aurora Technologies, a digital signage hardware and software provider. Images and videos can be instantly uploaded and displayed on multiple screens and locations, improving communication in hotels, museums, restaurants, medical facilities, retail environments, and school systems. AuroraDigitalSignage.com for more information.
Ahead on Ozarks, a proposal to help fund an expansion of Walton Arts Center moves forward. The Vine Brothers perform inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio, and more.
But first, the Arkansas House yesterday passed a bill that would require all voters to show some form of photo ID each time they vote.
As everyone voted, cast the ballots with 51 yeas, 44 nays, and zero present, to pass the bill.
There were questions as to whether the bill required a two-thirds majority to pass, as some had suggested it might, since it would be a change to the state's constitution. Speaking before the House, Republican Representative Stephen Meeks of Greenbrier brandished a list of documented voter fraud cases and told members the bill does not implement a poll tax. He also said the state would ensure anyone who needed an ID would be able to get one.
This bill also states that for those of our citizens that do not have identification, that the Secretary of State will provide to them an identification that they can use from there in perpetuity. That will be provided for them at no cost.
Speaking against the measure, Representative Darren Williams of Little Rock, a Democrat, said the bill would make it harder for people to vote despite their determination to do so.
There are far too many people who are elderly, who are poor, who suffer from not driving and not don't have transportation, who may have a hard time fulfilling the requirements necessary to this bill to vote, though they are registered.
The bill, which has been amended, will now have to be reapproved by the Senate before it goes to the governor's desk.
A bill that would direct a portion of the state's general revenue to pay for highways in the years to come has many in state education and higher ed programs worried they'll lose a portion of their funding in the future. The bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Jonathan Barnett of Siloam Springs, says some general revenue needs to shift to highways because revenue sources like the state's fuel tax aren't keeping the state's highways adequately funded for upkeep.
20 years, it's flat. We don't have enough money to maintain the existing highway network system. And this bill will give us a little bit of future revenue growth on a limited basis that will help, you know, at least to maintain the existing highway network system. That's what we're trying to do.
At a Capitol rally organized by Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families for education and health groups to speak against the bill, Arkansas Education Association President Donna Morey told the crowd the bill would hurt education in the state.
Any time that general revenue is cut, there's going to be effects on the lives of so many families in Arkansas. And again, the speakers before have said so clearly, we all want good roads, highways for our citizens to travel, but not on the backs of public school students.
Barnett says his bill only skims off growth in general revenue and would create jobs for the state. A spokesman for Governor Mike Beebe says the governor is against general revenue going to highways.
This week, congressional lawmakers are outlining spending priorities for fiscal year 2013, and U.S. Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas says he supports a hybrid bill that includes appropriations from last year.
The Senate bill is good in the sense that it prevents a government shutdown. Second, it also gets us closer to what we call regular order. We're trying to get back in regular order on our appropriation bills and our budget and all that. This is a step in the right direction. And also, it's usually, on average, it's better than just a simple continuing resolution.
Next week, the Senate takes up the budget for the following year, and Senator John Bozeman says provisions in the budget must be based on pro-growth policies.
Right now, because of our indebtedness and our deficit, a lot of economists believe that that's one of the things that's holding us back and putting a lid on GDP. Getting our economic house back in order, doing the budgeting process — this is the first time the Senate's had a budget in 4 years — doing that process just like the people of Arkansas do every year, and certainly as a federal government, we need to do the same thing.
Senator Bozeman says some Arkansans are still unemployed and underemployed, while others simply have stopped looking for work. He says lawmakers have to make sure budget priorities don't hinder economic recovery efforts.
The next head of the University of Arkansas's Advancement Division will take the reins of the university's fundraising arm in less than 3 weeks' time. According to a press release issued by the university this morning, Chris Weirich will begin his duties as the Vice Chancellor of University Advancement on April 1st. Weirich's appointment to the position was announced last month, but no starting date was given to allow him to finish his duties as Executive Director of the Razorback Foundation. Brad Schott, Weirich's predecessor as head of the Advancement Division, will reportedly work with Weirich to ensure a smooth transition, though Schott will finish his current appointment as Capital Campaign Advisor and Development Officer. The shakeup to the Advancement Division leadership comes after the division ended the 2012 fiscal year with more than a $3.3 million budget deficit.
At this time last week, the Razorback baseball team was on the heels of a four-game losing streak, but then they got their regular announcer back, and they've had repeated home wins last weekend and this week. And now the Razorback baseball team has a six-game winning streak. They defeated Alabama A&M again yesterday, 13-0. That comes on the heels of their 20-2 win Tuesday night against Alabama A&M. Tomorrow night, the Razorbacks get to test their luck as they'll open conference play with a weekend series against number 8 in the country, Mississippi, at Baum Stadium.
Forecast calls for mostly clear skies tonight with overnight lows in the mid-40s. Tomorrow, Friday, sunny with highs in the upper 70s. Partly cloudy tomorrow night with lows around 52. The Walton Arts Center's expansion plans for its Fayetteville campus continue to move forward after a city commission pledged several hundred thousand dollars to the project, with the possibility for more money at a later date. Ozarks at Largest Timothy Dennis has more.
The Fayetteville Advertising and Promotion Commission this week announced its support of the expansion project set to reshape the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville for years to come. Part of that support comes from a grant from the AMP Commission Reserve Funds.
$600,000 is the largest amount we've ever given. In the past, it's been around $500,000. And that's what we gave to the university for their Performing Arts Center, as well as Botanical Gardens and Downtown Square renovations.
Marilyn Hefner is the executive director of the Fayetteville AMP Commission. For the Walton Arts Center to receive the AMP grant, Hefner says that the organization has agreed to meet five conditions set forth by the commission.
They're pretty standard. It's for an audit or quarterly reports and for them to do a capital campaign to raise the remainder of the money and not spend money on programming costs or administrative that would strictly be for the expansion project.
Walton Arts Center officials originally requested $1 million each in this year and next year to help with design costs. Although commissioners awarded less to the center this year than was requested, Walton Arts Center Chief Operating Officer Terry Trotter says that the grant will go a long way in kickstarting the expansion project.
The initial seed money right now is really exciting, and we're thrilled with that because, again, we now, you know, we're in the phase where we've got architects coming on board. We're really beginning to dig into that. What is this going to look like? How is this going to serve the functions that we need it to serve? And so that will allow us to do that over the next 6 to 9 months.
But the $600,000 grant is only one form of funding proposed by the AMP Commission at its meeting Monday. Commissioners also forwarded a proposal to the City Council that requested extending sales tax bonds originally used to build the Fayetteville Town Center. Extending those bonds could net as much as $6.5 million to the Walton Arts Center project, as well as about $3.2 million for a proposed regional park project off of Cato Springs Road. The only catch is that for the bonds to be extended, Hefner says that the City Council would have to put the issue before city voters.
With just the items that we presented, it will be a two-question ballot. Would you approve HMR taxes to go to the Walton Arts Center expansion project? And would you approve HMR tax to go to the regional park project? And, you know, depending on what the voters decide, then that project would, you know, go from there.
But as far as such an issue would go for expansion plans at the Walton Arts Center, Trotter is confident about the project's appeal to city residents.
One of the things that we've discovered as we have been talking to people about the plans that we have is there's a lot of enthusiasm for us. You know, when you look at some of the things that we're doing with our expansion, enlarging the lobby, you know, people who have been to Walton Arts Center to a sold-out show know how much we need that and what that's going to do to enhance people's experience where they're actually able to, you know, get a drink, maybe order a drink ahead of time, you know, stand and chat with their friends, not be completely, you know, scrunched in a corner because there's no space to move, be able to actually get through the lines at the restroom and still have time to enjoy a drink at intermission, things like that. So, you know, we know that there's huge excitement behind this project.
As for if or when the potential bond extension election could happen, that is up to the city council to decide. But considering the Walton Arts Center's tentative completion date for the Fayetteville expansion project set for sometime in 2015, Fayetteville aldermen are likely to address the issue sooner rather than later. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
This is Ozarks at Large. Medgar Evers is one of the most important figures in the Southern struggle with civil rights in the middle of the last century. His life is examined in the book Medgar Evers, Mississippi Martyr, published by the University of Arkansas Press. Recently, Ozarks at Large's Meredith Martin Motes talked to the author of the book, Michael Vincent Williams.
In 1963, civil rights activist and NAACP Field Secretary Medgar Evers was murdered in the driveway of his Mississippi home, shot in the back on the same evening President Kennedy gave a nationally televised speech in support of civil rights legislation. A recent book by Dr. Michael Vincent Williams, assistant professor of history at Mississippi State University, entitled Medgar Evers, Mississippi Martyr, explores Evers as both a mythic figure in the civil rights movement and as a human, a son, father, husband, neighbor, and friend. Never one to align himself with one specific strategy, as both an activist and an organizer, Evers was hard to pin down. For him, says Williams, the ultimate outcome was to get people connected.
Because for him, the biggest issue was the final product. You know, how can we get people interested? How can we get people to participate? How can we get people to tap into their inner power and then extend that outward for uplift to not only the community in which they live in, but the larger community as a whole.
Growing up in Mississippi, Williams and his seven brothers and sisters were homeschooled, and he first heard about Medgar Evers from his mother, a man she believed deserved greater recognition in the movement.
And so as children, she would always talk about Medgar Evers, and you've got to know who he is. And, you know, he was the NAACP field secretary. He's really, really important. So I grew up with that type of idea of the person in my subconscious.
While in graduate school, a professor asked Williams what he knew about Evers and suggested he dig deeper and begin researching Evers' life.
And for me at that point, it was just really kind of kismet.
In 2005, when the National Archives made Evers' papers available for researchers, Williams began exploring the events that led up to Evers choosing a life of activism in Mississippi. It began at home, explains Williams, with his parents instilling a sense of equality despite the institutionalized racism that enveloped the South.
And so they often talked about, you know, having pride in yourself, that you are as equal as anyone else. They were a family that was pretty much independent. They engaged in a lot of different businesses. You know, they had a funeral home, you know, beauty salons, you know, store, you know, that kind of sold food and things of that nature. And so Evers grew up with this kind of cocoon of self-sufficiency. And it really had a profound impact on who he saw himself, not only as a man, but also a black man, and what was possible.
In 1952, after college graduation, Evers goes to the Delta to work as an insurance salesman, an event that changes the course of his life.
And it's really here where he gets a real taste of what black oppression looks like, what it feels like, and how it manifests itself. He sees extreme poverty. He sees individuals who are in a sharecropping system that tantamounts to chattel slavery. And he notes that anybody who spends any time in the Delta, any time at all, soon wants to do something. And so the Delta really impacts him in terms of what his responsibilities are, because he sees it writ large, you know, with the people that he encounters and the kind of fear that's there and how whites in the Delta pretty much control everything with an iron fist.
Evers begins to work with the NAACP and grows increasingly uncomfortable with his middle-class job selling insurance to families mired in poverty and surrounded by violence. He begins reading more about independent African nations and movements such as the Mau-Mau Revolution, believing in the need for that kind of organized dedication, if perhaps not the violence. He partners with organizations like SNCC and CORE, and as NAACP field secretary, he begins organizing across the state, weaving in and out of the middle class, the grassroots, and everywhere in between.
The complexity of this is that Evers looks at the overall picture, and the overall picture was obtaining freedom, right? It was obtaining equality, it was obtaining everything that comes with full citizenship rights. And for him, there was no one set pattern for doing that, right? It was too complex an issue. It had too many moving parts, right? And so for him, you look at what's working, and then you develop it so that it fits the environment in which you are working in. Because what's going to work in the Delta will not necessarily work in Jackson. It will not necessarily work on the Gulf. But when you start putting everything together from different organizations, from different ideas, whether it's self-defense, whether it's nonviolence, whether it's sit-ins, whatever the tactic is, if it applies, he was really good about selling it, constructing it, and reevaluating it to the point that it works for whatever area he's at.
Perhaps one of the most striking aspects of Evers' role as both an organizer and an everyday human was his dedication to his home, Mississippi. He had numerous opportunities to leave, Williams explains, and spent a great deal of time traveling to California and Chicago, for example, experiencing firsthand the opportunities available to African Americans outside the South. But rather than choosing to leave, he worked to bring those freedoms back to Mississippi. It was this concept of home, says Williams, that permeated Evers' dedication.
And if you have a problem with your home, you don't just up and leave it. You work to fix those problems. But for Evers, the epitome of who he was that he really felt to leave Mississippi would be really kind of tantamount to treason or betrayal, you know, of what he was working to accomplish. Because it was not really for himself that he wanted these things. I mean, that would be nice. But he didn't believe that ultimately he would see a lot of what he was fighting for. But it was for the future generations that he believed he could not leave Mississippi, but had to work toward changing it. And he often said that if I die in this process, you know, this is a worthy trade-off.
On June 12, 1963, Evers pulled into his driveway, returning home from a meeting on school integration. Earlier that evening, President Kennedy had given a national speech in favor of civil rights legislation. Evers walked toward his house carrying recently printed T-shirts reading, "Jim Crow Must Go."
His wife and the children are waiting up for him.
She hears the car come in
right.
The driveway.
Right. And then their oldest child, Daryl, says, "Here comes Daddy." And then they hear the shot. Right? And so the neighbors come out, but he's laying there, and he's been shot in the back. And so this is, you know, it's blood everywhere. And his children come out, and they see their father in this state. Right, as well as his wife. But for the community at large, it really becomes a galvanizing event. You know? Because even though you had all these splits and rifts and problems that are going on in Jackson at that point, people begin to say, well, my God, if they can do this to this individual who was so committed, right, then change has got to come. Right? And so as a result of his assassination at that point, you start getting people, everybody's working together. It also impacts the white community as well. You know, because there's this great fear now that there's going to be mass rioting, mass violence, and things are going to get out of control. And so they also begin to see that there has to be some kind of change, because political assassination at that point, kind of impacts everybody.
Williams' book is so much more than just a life history. In many ways, it's a call to action. A biography, says Williams, should remove historical figures from the shadows of abstraction, allowing modern-day readers to grasp both their humanity and their complexity, ultimately inspiring us to find our own roles in the struggle today.
No matter where you are in this country, there are problems there. I think what this book does, and what Evers does, is it really kind of puts you in the frame of mind that there is a responsibility that you as an individual have to change in the circumstances around you, whatever that may be. And so ultimately, what I would like for the book to be is sort of a historical look forward. You know? And when I say that, meaning that you're looking at the past, but you understand that those problems still exist in the present. Now, how can I utilize those types of ideas, that kind of commitment, that kind of devotion to change to our present situations and our present struggles, whether it's resegregation in the school system, whether it's white flight, whether it's violence, whether it's high prison rates, whether it's HIV and AIDS, whether it's abuse, whatever those problems are, how can I work toward changing those and what kind of strategies?
Dr. Michael Vincent Williams is the author of the book Medgar Evers, Mississippi Martyr, published by the University of Arkansas Press. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin Motes.
Meredith Martin Motes is the editor of The Boiled Down Juice and the director of the McElroy House Organization for Folklife, Oral History, and Community Action. She's a regular contributor to Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, March 14th, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now is Becca Martin Brown. She's features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Lord of the Rings.
I'm familiar with the books and the movie.
Can you hear music from the movie in your head?
Okay.
If you do, the person playing the flute in your head is Sir James Galway. He was knighted by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II in 2001 for services to music. And he's played for queens, presidents, and a pope. And he's a smart aleck. He really is. We talked on the phone prior to his performance tonight at the Walton Art Center. Here's some examples. Why did you play the flute? Well, I began playing the violin, but it was infested with woodworm, and eventually they won.
So he's a bit of a jester.
Yeah. So you're a huge supporter of the arts. Why? Well, you become good at languages, you read all of the musical notations in Italian, and pretty soon you can order spaghetti. All righty. And my favorite, what's it like to be a knight? People don't know what to call me. It's supposed to be Sir James, and my wife is Lady Galway, but everybody I know calls me Jimmy anyway.
Oh.
He'll be performing tonight as what's called a legacy tour, not because he's retiring, but he's playing a lot of his favorite music, at 7 o'clock at the Walton Art Center in Fayetteville, and tickets start at $28.
One quick question. Is he Irish?
Yes.
Okay.
And the second half of the program will include a lot of Irish music.
Okay. Thank you. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This afternoon, Patricia Limerick, a professor of history at the University of Colorado, will deliver a lecture in the 2013 Hartman Hotz Lecture Series. Her talk will put the current public discussion of natural gas development and fracking into a larger historical context of extractive industries in the American West.
Why would a historian get into this whole complicated, very highly charged discussion? On my campus at the University of Colorado, we are at Well, I guess it's not unusual. We're a campus where the sciences and engineering are much more visible and much more highly ranked. And I used to mope over that, I guess, and sulk. And then I thought, actually, they're doing stuff that really has historical dimensions, but they're not, they don't seem to notice that. So I ended up with our Center of the American West at the University of Colorado. We do a lot of work with scientists and engineers. And a consortium, big group of 27 people altogether, put together a proposal of the National Science Foundation, mostly engineering professors and science professors, to look at natural gas and fracking and to do whatever we can to launch a more evidence-based discussion. Our format is to say what we know, what we don't know, and what we hope to learn, which seems to me very refreshing in an atmosphere where there's excesses of certainty that are not actually based on findings. So I am the person doing historical perspective and public communications for this National Science Foundation grant. It's a $12 million grant over 5 years.
This morning, Patricia Limerick came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio in advance of today's talk. She says any conversation about natural gas development or the use of any natural resource should be done in a reasonable manner, rising above bumper sticker ideology.
Yes, indeed, we have a giant history of extractive industry in the West, and we have mixed outcomes. And some of them are open pit mines that will never be, well, geologically speaking, the next million years. There may be some differences in that, but those are there for a long, long haul. And then other places that were very intensely changed by extractive industry are now considered beautiful places. People go to Aspen, which was an all-out mining town, and they do not go to Aspen in order to see the devastation of the earth. They go to take part in another form of disturbance of the earth. That the, there's no clear cut like a ski slope, really. That so that there's places that went under very heavy extraction that are now considered very beautiful. Durango, Colorado had smelters, and the vegetation around the smelters, there was the hillsides were bare, and now people are hoping that they can go vacation in Durango. And
the word you always hear at Durango now is charming.
And well, you might, because it is charming. And then in the airport, this is actually part of my remarks later, when I was flying here, in my speech, I have some reflections on Durango and its resilience and how beautiful it is now and what a, man, smelters just going and fumes I can't think what was happening to people's lungs at that time. So in the Denver airport, there's a beautiful photograph of Durango advertising Fort Lewis College, and it says liberal arts education, and the adjective they use is so comical in historical perspective. It says breathtaking liberal arts education, and you think, well, fortunately, we're talking in the light and merry form of breathtaking, but 100 years ago, I guess, 120 years ago, breathtaking, you bet, but in a really different way. So this concept of resilience is really an important thing. But also a really important question is how much disturbance of environments comes from things that look much more benign to us, that suburban sprawl, for instance. Well, not everyone finds that benign, but people who consider those suburbs to be their treasured homes, if a natural gas development is going in there, there's a real sense of, this is Eden. This is paradise. We can't have extraction. While the very lawn that the person is—
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I was just in Arizona, and I was going up and down streets, and there were these green lawns. And you're thinking in the desert, that doesn't happen naturally.
No, it does not happen. And actually, one of the more comical aspects of Western history over time is that it's the interior West is not a particularly bright green place. Olive green, maybe, and yet that concept of the right landscape is a bright green landscape that drove a lot of the settlement of the West. And cities like Denver within a decade and a half had turned into places with lawns and gardens and so on. But it's quite an imposition. And when you see something that is bright green in the interior West, you can be pretty sure that somebody built an infrastructure and moved water around, stored it, and supplied it in the summer and so on. So bright green is actually the color of disturbance.
We'll hear much more from our conversation with Patricia Limerick on a future edition of Ozarks at Large. Her talk today is at 4 in Giffel's Auditorium in Old Main on the University of Arkansas campus. The Hartman Hotz Lecture Series is sponsored by the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences and the University of Arkansas School of Law.
The defense argued that a former New York cop only fantasized about cooking and eating women. A federal jury disagreed. They convicted the so-called cannibal cop of conspiracy to kidnap and other charges. I'm Neil Conan. Where's the line between thought and deed? Plus, what to make of the latest threats from a nuclear North Korea? Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation just ahead at 1 o'clock here on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellams.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And with us, Jody Beznoska, who's Vice President of Communications at Walton Arts Center.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back, Kyle.
Thank you.
We missed you.
Well, thank you. I missed doing this. Happy Pi Day, by the way.
Oh, like the 3.14 day.
Yes.
Okay.
Which I just watched Life of Pi the night before last.
Yeah.
Well, I remember a couple weeks ago it was International Pie, P-I-E,
right.
Day, and I missed
right.
getting pie, so people told me I could have some today.
There you go.
So I'll have to go find some. Nice.
Walton Arts Center doesn't have anything to the public today, do they?
Yes, actually we do. Today is
Galway. Galway.
Yes.
James Galway. Sir James Galway,
Sir
who
James
I talked to.
Galway.
Yes.
What was he like?
He was so charming
yeah.
and so approachable and so, I hate to say normal, but
yeah.
he could have talked longer, you know.
Cool. Yes, he performs tonight, 7 o'clock. He performs with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
They're performing their flute legacy tour. They'll be doing Irish jigs. They'll be doing Debussy. They'll be doing all kinds of...
Some Mancini.
Yeah.
I mean, it reflects his career
mm-hmm.
from very serious classical
mm-hmm.
to pop.
To pop and fun, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we're... 2 days away from St. Patrick's Day, so
yes.
I happen to know there will be Irish-themed beverages and decor in our lobby.
Wonderful.
So it'll be a nice night.
And you're wearing green.
I am wearing green. Didn't mean to.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
It wasn't on purpose, but I am doing it. So.
So Sir James Galway.
Sir James Galway and Lady Jean Galway tonight,
mm-hmm.
7 o'clock. Then tomorrow night, the 15th, we have One Night of Queen.
Right.
And that, as far as I know, is, if not completely at capacity, almost there. So you might have to get on a waiting list for that one. But that's an 8 o'clock show tomorrow night.
So tonight a night,
mm-hmm.
tomorrow night a queen.
Mm-hmm. And then Saturday a harmonica player.
Okay.
Kind of broke the metaphor there, sorry. But no, the Grégoire Marais Quartet is playing on Saturday, two performances, 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock. And he is an incredible jazz harmonica player. So neat to think we're going to, that's just going to be a cool sound.
And I know that, I don't know if he'll do at his shows this weekend, but I know he has, you know, channeled Stevie Wonder before and recorded some Stevie Wonder songs.
Oh, wow. Well, we don't know what he's going to do,
okay.
But it should be a fun evening. That's in Star Theater, so that's in the smaller club, so it's a little more mm-hmm. intimate, a little more like a jazz club. I did want to mention that the Community Creative Center, which is one of our resident companies, they have all kinds of classes going on right now that you can go to our website and it'll take you off to their site and look at their whole lineup of arts classes for kids and adults. So you should check that out if you feel like getting creative.
Okay.
Let's see. And then next week is spring break, so we don't have much in the way of programming. In fact, most of us will be getting caught up on work in the office next week.
Good.
And then the following week becomes busy. On the 27th, we have the TEDx Fayetteville event, which we were just talking mm-hmm. about. As far as I know, that is sold out, so we're taking a waiting list for that. That's a all-day event, more like a conference than a concert.
And that's in Baumwalker?
No, that's actually in Star Theater.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And eventually, if you didn't get a ticket, you will be able to see the TEDx talks online.
One of the great things about any TED program is that all the talks are recorded and produced and edited very professionally, and they're well done, and then they're put up on the web on YouTube, and anyone can view them. So it'll be great. That's the 27th. That's a Wednesday. On the Thursday, the 28th, Garrison Keillor will be here.
And that is close to being sold out
as
well.
It is very close to that, yep. You might have a wait list for that one, too. And for anybody who wants to know, waiting list works like this. You can come down to the box office about an hour prior to the show, put your name on the list, and if tickets come available or they get turned back or for some reason, you know, the holds that we have get released, then you're able to get in and off you go. And our box office is really good at trying to get people in. So that's Thursday the 28th, the 7 o'clock show. On, I think it's Saturday the 30th, we have Circa, which is the next show in our 10 by 10 series.
The penultimate show of this year's 10 by 10.
Mm-hmm, correct. A modern dance circus kind of show, more modern dance than circus, I think. But tickets are flying for that one as well. So don't wait if you really want to see that. And the great thing about 10 by 10 is that they're $10 tickets, and there's a pre-show creative conversation and a post-show party, and it's generally a really good time.
It is.
So that is March. Let's look ahead into April really quick. Of course, we're going to talk about Anything Goes. Before we get to Anything Goes, let's talk about Popovich Comedy Pet Theater. That's the first show in our sort of little mini Arts for Animals campaign that we're working on. And there's a really cool campaign that we're running right now in partnership with the Humane Society, where if you purchase a ticket to any of our animal-themed shows coming up in the next couple months, we will donate $1 per ticket to the Humane Society, up to $2,000. So that's a chance to get that organization, you know, a couple grand, which is really cool.
And you have a ton of animal-related shows coming up.
I don't know why we suddenly wound up with all these animals, but we have them. So we start with the Popovich Comedy Pet Theater, which is the 6th of April, two performances. And this is I think the best way to describe this guy is he's a clown, but he's not that scary clown that everybody, you know, freaks out about. He does circus work, he does clown work, but he does them with rescue pets of all kinds. Geese, rabbits, cats, dogs, all of them. And I watched a video the other day, and it was just the cutest thing I've ever seen. You know, these cats are like walking on high wires, and the dogs are jumping through hoops, and it's really, and balancing, like he's standing on a chair, on a ladder, on a basketball, balancing a cat on his hand, you know, and it's just really, really cute. So that's the 6th of April. And then Anything Goes from the 9th through the 14th of April. 7 shows of Anything Goes. And that's the Cole Porter, the big, beautiful Cole Porter musical.
Classic.
And it's got some of the best tap dancing you will see ever. And then also yesterday, some of you may have seen this on social media, but we have announced our Artisphere Festival
How
lineup.
How did I miss that?
Well, it was a little quiet. We haven't sent out a big, massive email yet or anything like that. A lot of this has been on sale already, but this was the big announcement. This was the whole lineup, and it is awesome. It's really busy. Jack Hanna is our first real show for that, but we'll have programming up at the Bentonville First Friday. We will have the Trail Mix concert tour. We'll be back this year, be doing it a little bit differently than we've done it in the past. Trail Mix has been out at Lake Fayetteville for the past, I think it's three years. This year it's going to be downtown on the Frisco Trail.
That is different.
And then later, it's on the Crystal Bridges
Trail. And then
on
the Crystal Bridges Trail.
Same day.
So it's sort of Trail Mix starts in Fayetteville and continues on into Bentonville in one day.
With different bands?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep, different bands, a wide variety of them, yeah.
And it's the same day as Spring Fest in Fayetteville, the Rejuvenated Spring Fest.
Yep.
Big day.
Big day. That's the 4th, I believe,
yes,
of May, which is a Saturday. And that's sort of our first big hurrah weekend for Artisphere. And, of course, the Artisphere Festival Orchestra will be back in June this year with some really exciting stuff going on that I think maybe we'll just tease that now and talk about that.
You'll hear much more about it.
Yeah, that is, this is a big year for that. So all kinds of things going on.
And you'll be back spring break, right? You'll still be here.
I will be here.
Okay, and we'll talk more about Artisphere then.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan.
Okay. People can find out more?
Yes, at waltonartscenter.org, or you can call 443-5600, or you can visit the box office, or you can go to artisphere.org, which is the new website that we also just launched a couple days ago.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Jody.
Thank you, Jody.
Jody Beznoska is Vice President for Communications at Walton Arts Center.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
We are inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio, and we are very lucky because with us, the Vine Brothers, who have a CD titled Low Rent, and who will be performing tonight in Fayetteville, tomorrow.
Tonight in Fort Smith.
Tonight in Fort Smith, tomorrow in Fayetteville.
Right.
Okay. Vine Brothers, do you mind introducing yourselves? Garrett, let's start with you.
I'm Garrett Jones.
I'm Joe Credit 3.
And I'm Greg Bucking.
How did Jones, Credit, and Bucking become the Vine Brothers?
Well, we met as a backing band for Arkansas musician Opal Fly a few years back. And it just kind of grew out of that when that kind of fell apart. Joe and I started writing songs and working with various bass players. And then when Garrett's availability became more available, we started playing with Garrett and touring and recording, and I've been doing that for a couple of years now.
This current tour, you've been to some places, right?
Oh, yeah. We've been all over. I started in Saratoga Springs when the snow was deep, and we're here. We're probably going to end it. Well, we are going to end it in Mississippi. So we've been
through all kinds of weather, mostly cold and miserable.
But yes, it is. We should probably call this the weather tour. We've gone through sleet, snow, rain, ice. It's kind of like we're the postman.
That being said, what is your tour bus like?
It's a
tour
Subaru.
Van.
Yeah. Subaru. We have two. We have dueling Subarus.
All wheel drive.
Not a bad choice for an all weather sort of tour.
Yeah, it's nice with just a 3-piece. You can squeeze everybody in there, and it's fairly comfortable. So, you know. A
few times it's looked like a Subaru commercial.
Yep.
Climb the mountain in the snow.
Does going all over hill and dale in the same vehicle? Does it? You know, create companionship? Does it create better songwriting?
I think so.
Sure.
I think so. I mean, when we're riding around, I mean, we pretty much just listen to music and talk about just whatever comes to our heads. And you know, you really get to know each other when you're out on the road, I think.
Get a lot of good laughs either way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Find a lot of hardwood floors to sleep on.
Yeah. Couches.
Okay, so tonight's show's in Fort Smith. Where in Fort Smith?
At Landry's.
Ah, okay.
Our first time there, actually.
Good place, good venue. Yeah.
And then tomorrow night in Fayetteville?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We'll be at Mojo's Pines and Pies.
Okay.
And we've been there a bunch of times, so we have a lot of fun times there.
The CD is titled Low Rent. The first song, Greg, is one that you wrote, Sweet Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. It's something that, just a real simple song. When we were doing the tracks for this album, I actually kind of wrote it as we were doing that, and came up with the chorus first. And, you know, it just came pretty naturally, and it's been, you know, it's pretty catchy, and a lot of people have responded really positively to it. So it's been one of our standard showpieces on the road.
Yeah. It has accordion on the CD.
It does. We have... Ashley Ziggy from a band called Dump Truck Butterlips. They're out of Lawrence. I think they're in Austin.
They're Austin now,
they're
yeah.
Austin, yeah. yeah.
But we did some shows with them, and you know, we thought that would fit nice on that song, so we had her play on Sweet Eyes.
All the little tricks that you know. When I try to give you all of mine, you only take a little sliver at a time. Sweet eyes, tell me what you wanna know.
And a couple of new songs that you're going to have for us in here, is that right?
Yeah. Been fun. We've been in the studio all this week, and yeah. like I say, we've been hashing all these things out, but yeah, I think we're going to probably play Black Sky.
All righty. This song's about a storm. Here we go.
Imagine that has had some enthusiastic response if you've tested that in some venues.
We talked about, you know, road tripping a lot. Are these songs that you maybe talked about on this last tour?
It's been nice. We've definitely been road testing them. So yeah. Majority, I think there's only maybe two tunes that we kind of wound up piecing together this last week and the last little bits and forms. But for the most part, these have all been, it's been nice. We've had a year since making this last disc, Low Rent, and had a year now to road test a few of these new songs and get them all fit and piece together. So it's nice. Mm-hmm. Once you get in there, it was pretty easy tracking. It's just literally getting in and doing it, knocking it out.
Yeah. Which studio are you recording in?
Actually, working out of our home. It's a joy part about the world these days. So if you get some good microphones, it's similar to what we did with this last one. But it's been a joy this time actually having the time blocked out with all of us together. Last time was kind of piecing everybody together from various corners, from Greg up in New York to Joe in Kansas City to me and here in Fayetteville. And then, like I say, Ziggy and Lawrence and everybody sprawled about. Yeah, exactly. We did all sorts of tracking all over the place. It's been nice to go around to get everybody under one roof and be able to do it. I think the furthest thing we're on doing this one so far is shaping up is probably have to get one of my violin friends out of the UK to do a part for us. But I think that's about the other than that, it's been nice being able to bring everybody in into my house, let's go around and be able to sit down and do it on our time. So that's a real joy about the matters these days. So
yeah, we have a couple of good local musicians who did some guest spots on a couple of the tunes. We got a banjo on a couple of tunes.
Adam's coming on banjo on that.
Collins, who was in the studio just a few minutes ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there you go.
With Cutty Rye.
He's just all over the place, yeah. So yeah, but it's been fun. So.
He also did a really nice vibraphone track on one of them, and then we got R.J. Michaud do some harp.
All right.
So it's going to be a nice little mixture of sounds and styles going
on. I love how the local musicians all collaborate and support one another.
Yeah, that's a real joy in this area. Yeah. Everybody's pretty willing to work and help with each other.
Fayetteville is definitely blessed for that. It's kind of one of the best music scenes, I think, in the country, really. You go travel around a little bit, you really see it.
Yeah, there's a great community.
Yeah. Absolutely.
When will you? When will you be on the road again? I mean, when will you take off?
Technically, we're in the middle of it right now.
So you're still
in the middle. We've kind of taken this week and a half off here because I hadn't been home in 2 months. And it was,
oh, that's right. You're going to end in Mississippi. Right?
Yeah. So, but anyway,
technically, I'm still on the road.
Yep. Yeah,
that's true. It's not your home you're recording in.
I'm finally home. So but just these guys aren't. So
I'm excited about this tour because we're gonna busk down in the French Quarter or in New Orleans. That is an awful lot of fun.
On Easter.
Yeah, on Easter Sunday.
March 31st, right?
Yeah. I love street performance.
Do you know where on Bourbon yet or where in the French Quarter?
Wherever we don't get chased off.
Someone else's spot. Yeah.
We'll edge our way around a little bit, see if we can find a good spot. But I've done that before and it was really entertaining. Really entertaining.
Profitable?
Yeah.
Entertaining.
Yeah,
it was actually quite profitable. Quite profitable. I paid my hotel and the formidable beer bill.
So busking actually gets you quite a few other gigs, at least with an ensemble like this. That's an interesting thing. I mean, it's coming. I do a lot of theater work and other stuff, but it's actually fun with an ensemble like this because you get to actually take the performance, an acoustic performance. You can actually take it to the streets and be able to take it directly to the people. And it's like we have a real joy doing the farmers market up here. Like we were doing that this fall on and off when we were back in town up here. And it always went over remarkably well. I actually went better over at the farmers market, it seems like, than the clubs, which is kind of remarkable. That kind of maybe the sign of the times or something. But
and you get to play for kids. You never see kids in a bar anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's about. But,
Well, I was going to say maybe it's part of the, it's unexpected. People don't go, they're not walking down the street and they don't expect to hear this, great music. And
yeah.
So.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the next CD, no firm date yet when it might be out?
Nothing firm. I can say we wrapped up today. We finally wrapped up all the takes. So it's into the can officially. So we're having to set up some time with one of our friends is going to help mix it out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And just got to set up a date with him here in the next couple of weeks that we can all meet up together and work it all out. So,
yeah, it went really quickly. Like, I really wasn't expecting. I just figured we'd get our basic tracks with the rhythm section and kind of work on other songs later. And we just kind of started banging them out.
It ends up we knew the songs after all.
Yeah, I mean, we've been playing most of them for over a year. So it kind of went pretty easy.
The Vine Brothers are Garrett Jones, Joe Credit 3, and Greg Bucking. Their next CD has yet to be titled and will be out sometime in 2013. You can see them tonight at Landry's in Fort Smith and at Mojo's Pints and Pies tomorrow night in Fayetteville. They played another song before they left the Furman Garner Performance Studio. This, too, will be on their forthcoming CD. Default. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Viney Grove.
I love Viney Grove. I used to ride my bicycle out there.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Dirtfoot is coming to town.
They are. Tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow is Friday at George's Majestic Lounge. Guess what? We have two tickets.
We do.
That we're going to give away to one winner. No trivia question here. Just enter.
Email ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
Right. And tomorrow we will randomly pick a winner. Here's the thing. It'll be will call, so you'll just go to George's, but you're only going to have a few hours' notice. Live on the edge. So Dirtfoot at George's. If you want two free tickets, go to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
We'll put your name in the ceramic cow and draw one at random.
Antoinette Grajeda is going to talk to them when they're here on Friday. And that'll be on a future edition of Ozarks at Large. Love that musicians come to us and go inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
I'll see you tonight at Pigsibition.
Yes.
All right.